Shalom Haravardix, Shalom Talmidim. Great to have you back for our next session in the 12 Minor Prophets as we go through these 12 very, very important books of the Bible. We're starting with the book of Hosea, and we're in session 3. Session 1 and session 2 covered my teaching distinctives, my hermeneutical position. Now, as we get into session 3, we're getting into the book of into the 12 Minor Prophets in particular. We'll be looking at an introduction to the 12 minor prophets and then move right into the book of Hosea. Now, the outlines that we'll be using, the material that we'll be using, is REL Ministries Exegetical Outline Notes developed by Dr. Arnold G. Fruchtenbaum. And we have those notes available for you. You can download the introduction material that we'll be covering in just a few minutes from the Hadavar website. So download the PDF file entitled Introduction. Also download the PDF file entitled Hosea Class Notes. That'll be your major notes for this class on Hosea. And then also download the Hosea Handouts PDF file. There's some additional handouts that I have given out to students in the past, and so those are available for you as well. Those handouts are all ready to go. All right, so that is our preparation for the Minor Prophets. Now let's take a look at an overview, a generic overview, a summary of the Minor Prophets. What are these books all about? Well, let's begin with the title. Point A on your outline for the Minor Prophets. In the Jewish division, this is one book. And the common title for this one book is called The Twelve. It's also very commonly known under the Aramaic title Tre'asar. So you may see it that way as well. So that's the Jewish title. The Christian title is the Minor Prophets. That came down to us from Augustine. But when we talk about minor, we're not talking about inferiority. We're talking about minor in size only, not in content, not in importance. The content is just as important and just as high a quality, because the author is the same. The author is the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. So we need to treat the Minor Prophets with the same respect and the same interest that we treat the Major Prophets, the longer prophets. The Minor Prophets are just shorter in size, but in no way inferior to any other book of the Bible. All right, point two, the Septuagint order. The Septuagint is the Greek version of the Tanakh that was translated by the rabbis before the first century. And the Septuagint order is just a little different than the Masoretic order. Hosea, Amos, Micah, and Joel are the first four books of the Septuagint order, and then the rest follow in the classic Masoretic text order that we have today. Point three, the bottom of the page, the chronological order of the prophets. Now, our study will not follow the chronological order. We will be following the English canonical order, just going through your Bible, minor prophet by minor prophet. But that is not exactly the way they preached their messages or brought their messages to Israel. So let's take a look, first of all, at the kingdom period. I'd like to overview the kingdom period for you so that you'll understand the content of the prophets, of their messages. Now, the kingdom period began at the end of the period of the judges. Samuel was the last judge of Israel over the 12 tribes, and he judged Israel from 1067 to 1053. But then Samuel anointed the first king, and that was King Saul. He anointed him in approximately 1053. Saul reigned over the 12 tribes until 1013. He was then followed by David. David reigned from 1013 to 973. And then David's son took over the throne, Solomon, from 973 to 933. So that was the period of the United Kingdom. But in 933, the kingdom went through a split over the issue of taxes. And there was a bit of a civil war between these two branches of the kingdom of Israel. And when it all settled down, Judah was the southern kingdom, and Israel was the northern kingdom. 10 tribes made up the northern kingdom of Israel, and two tribes made up the southern kingdom of Judah, Judah and Benjamin. Benjamin then, I believe it was Benjamin, then assimilated into the southern kingdom. So basically we have Judah and Israel, the southern kingdom and the northern kingdom. Now I've placed the split of the kingdom at the top of the slide now. The northern kingdom of Israel was destroyed in 722 by the Assyrians. The southern kingdom of Judah lasted a little longer. They were sent into exile starting in 605 by the Babylonians. The Babylonians began to exile the royalty of Judah in 605. And so the kingdom now went into an exiled state. That state of exile ended in 536, and the kingdom was restored during the Persian period when the Jewish people were allowed to return to our homeland by the Persians. So this is the time frame of the writing prophets, 845 to 424 BC. Now, at the beginning of the time frame, under the divided kingdom, we have Obadiah, Joel, Amos, Jonah, and Hosea. About the middle of the period, just before the exile, we have Micah, Nahum, Habakkuk, and Zephaniah. Now, during the exile itself, Ezekiel and Daniel were the prophets of the exile. Jeremiah also would fit in there as well, but we're not studying them. They're not contained in the minor prophets. Now, at the beginning of the restoration period, we have Haggai and Zechariah. And at the end of the restoration period, we have the prophet Malachi. So that's a brief overview of the kingdom period that we're looking at. Now, as far as the chronological order goes, on your outline at the bottom of the page, you see Obadiah was the first prophet of the minor prophets, prophesying around 845. There's some alternate dates for him there, however. Joel in 835, Amos from 810 to 750, Jonah from 824 to 783, Hosea from 790 to 722. Then on page 2 of your outline, Micah from 739 to 702, Nahum 663 to 654, Habakkuk 640 to 622 with some possible alternate dates there on your outline, Zephaniah 630 to 626 and again some possible alternate dates. Haggai had a very short ministry, September, October, November, and December of 520. Zechariah then followed him, 520 to 470, and then Malachi is the last prophet of the prophetic period and of the minor prophets, 433 to 424. In 424, prophecy ceased in Israel until the appearance of John the Baptist, All right, now the geographical divisions of the nation at this time. Here we have a map of the United Kingdom of David and Solomon. One country under the rule of one king. 12 tribes under the rule of one king. But then in 933 we had that split between Israel and Judah, and this is a map of the divided monarchy, approximately 850 BC. To the north we have the 10 northern tribes called Israel. And Amos and Hosea will prophesy to the northern kingdom, to Israel. In the south, we have the kingdom of Judah, that green area to the south, the kingdom of Judah. And the prophets that will prophesy to Judah are Obadiah, Joel, Micah, Nahum, Zephaniah, and Habakkuk. All those prophets will prophesy to the southern kingdom. The restoration will then come under the Persians. Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi will prophesy to the restoration community. And then at the bottom of the page, you have D, Assyria, Jonah. Jonah will prophesy to the Assyrians, far to the north and to the east of Israel. All right, page 3 in your outline, we come to point 5, the historical background. So we'll begin by looking at the Assyrian period. Now, the Assyrian period is marked by 5 Assyrian invasions of the land of Israel. Five invasions come against Israel and Judah from the north and the east of the countries. Now, the first campaign is of Tiglath-Pileser III from 743 to 742. This is covered in 2 Kings 15, 19, and 20. Tiglath-Pileser made Israel under King Menachem a tributary. Israel had to pay tribute to the Assyrians. The second campaign of Tiglath-Pileser followed. This was provoked by the alliance of Syria and Israel against Assyria. Syria and Israel, the northern kingdom, allied against Assyria, trying to throw off the Assyrian yoke. And of course, Tiglath-Pileser did not approve of that, so he came over, he destroyed Damascus in Syria, he captured all the Galilean tribes, and now he made Judah a tributary. Judah had to pay tribute to Assyria. Point C, Shalmaneser V invaded the area from 725 to 722. He destroyed Israel, and Judah remained a tributary, giving tribute to Assyria. Point D, Sargon II came in 711. He came through the area to put down an uprising by Ashdod in Isaiah 20, and Judah remained under the Assyrian thumb as a tributary. And finally, the last Assyrian king is Sennacherib. His invasion was instigated by the revolt of Hezekiah, and all the fortified cities of Judah were destroyed except Jerusalem. And Hezekiah had thrown off the Assyrian yoke and stopped paying tribute for a short time, but now Judah becomes a tributary colony, a tributary state, a tributary province once again to the Assyrians. The prophets during that time period, again, are Amos, Jonah, Hosea, Isaiah, he's a major prophet, Micah, and Nahum. Those are the prophets prophesying to the nation of Israel and Judah during that time. Point B, we come to the Babylonian period. The Babylonians destroyed Assyria in 614 to 612. Their kingdom was destroyed by the Babylonians. And then the Babylonians entered into three campaigns against Judah, the surviving Jewish Commonwealth of Judah. The first campaign and deportation came in 606 to 605. And this was the Babylonian king Nabopolassar, and his government transitioned into the hands of his son Nebuchadnezzar during this time. The Babylonians then began to deport the royalty of Judah back over to Babylon, and this is when Daniel and his three friends were deported over to Babylon. The second campaign and deportation by the Babylonians occurred in 598 to 597. King Jehoiachin was now taken into exile in Babylon, and the prophet Ezekiel was taken during this deportation as well. And finally, the third campaign is in 586. Nebuchadnezzar got sick and tired of these uppity Jews always rebelling against him, and so he decided to come in and take care of the issue once and for all. This third campaign was instigated by the revolt of King Zedekiah, the last king of the Jewish tribe of Judah there, of the kingdom of Judah. So Nebuchadnezzar, tired of all the revolts, came in, he destroyed Jerusalem, and he destroyed the first temple, and the times of the Gentiles begin, the times of Gentile domination over the nation of Israel had begun. And the prophets during the Babylonian era, Habakkuk, Zephaniah, Jeremiah, and Ezekiel are major prophets in Babylon. Obadiah, and then Daniel. Daniel is also one of a major prophet, but he is also in Babylon. Then comes the Persian period. We're in page 5.C, the Persian period. Here's a map of the Persian Empire at its greatest extent. Cyrus, the Persian, captured Babylon. He captured Babylon pretty much intact, and that put the Jews of both the Assyrian captivity and the Babylonian captivity under one ruler, under one country. So here is the Persian Empire at its greatest extent. And again, the red arrow indicates they allowed the Jewish people to return to our homeland. And here is a map of the Persian province of Judah. The Persian province of Judah. We're just a Judah, just a province among the many provinces of the Persian Empire. And the prophets of this time period, Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi, the post-exilic prophets. Now, point six at the bottom of page five, what are the main themes we'll look at as we go through the major prophets? Excuse me, as we go through the minor prophets. I'm getting myself mixed up here, aren't I? Well, we'll look at great themes and truths and principles regarding God and man. We'll look at a lot of condemnation for sin, because the northern and southern kingdom got into a lot of immoral stuff and false worship. Well, but we'll also see comfort for the remnant. Those who are faithful to God are comforted by him with his love. And we'll also look at things to come, both far and near. And those things to come are indicated in the prophetic periods. And remember those prophetic time frames, that chart I showed you earlier? Well, we'll review that chart now. I'd like you to add, between point 7, prophetic periods, and point A, their own times, I'd like you to add the note, the distant past or near past. And that's a rare occurrence, agreed. I believe it only happens in Micah 5:2, and he's dealing with the distant past. So we have the distant past or the near past. We also have the prophets covering their own present time. This is the prophet's present time, what's going on there. Then they go into the near future. The near future consists of the Assyrian deportation, the Assyrian conquest, the Babylonian conquest, the exile, and the return under Persia. So a lot of activity happens in the near future to these prophets. They'll also cover the Messiah's first coming. There'll be messianic prophecy about the first coming. There'll be prophecy about the tribulation period, prophecy about the second coming of the Messiah, and also a glimpses, wonderful glimpses into the thousand-year messianic kingdom. So that is an overview of the 12 minor prophets. So right now we're going to begin the first minor prophet proper, and that is the book of Hosea. So remember, the material we have for the book of Hosea is the Hosea class notes. So be sure and go to the Hadavar website and download that PDF file if you haven't done so already, and then download the Hosea handouts PDF file if you haven't done that already, and you'll be all set for the material we're going to cover right now. All right, so let's begin with some introductory comments found in Hosea chapter 1, verse 1. Hosea 1:1. The word of the Lord which came to Hosea, the son of Beeri, during the days of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, kings of Judah, and during the days of Jeroboam, the son of Joash, king of Israel. Well, first of all, what is the prophet's name? The prophet's name is Hoshea, and the meaning of his name is salvation. The root of the Hebrew word Hoshea is Yasha, which means salvation or deliverance. And so his name is akin to Joshua and Jesus. Yehoshua, Yeshua, and Hoshea. All of them basically meaning salvation. We don't know much about his family, point B. We know that he was the son of Be'eri. Be'eri means my well. A Be'er is a well. And in Jewish tradition, Hosea's father was considered a flowing source of Torah wisdom. That's why he was named my well. But that's, of course, rabbinic tradition only. So really, nothing else is known of Hosea's family except his very, very personal and very difficult marital problems, which is the key to this whole book. Point C, the date. Well, in the heading, we have a number of kings of Judah mentioned. We have Uzziah from 790 to 737, Jotham from 739 to 735, Ahaz from 735 to 715, as Hezekiah, 715 to 686. So we know the time frames of these kings of Judah. Now, the curious thing is the fact that Hosea was from the north. Hosea was from the north, from the country of Israel, the kingdom of Israel. Yet he dates his activity by listing four southern kings. Why would he list four southern kings? Well, the answer lies in the fact that he was probably recognizing that the Davidic line from Judah was the true and legitimate rulers of the entire nation. And this split was an undesirable condition in the nation. Okay, page 8 on your outline. What were the kings of Israel during Hosea's prophesying? Well, the only one he names is Jeroboam II, and he reigned from 781 to 753. But if we look at the kings of Judah list, and we know their dates, we know that other southern kings were included. So Hosea prophesied during the reign of these southern kings. First of all, these northern kings. These are the northern kings that were reigning during the time frame of the southern kingdom as well. So the northern king Zechariah was the last of Jehu's dynasty in 753. Shalom was reigning in 752. Menachem, 752 to 741. Pekahiah, 741 to 739. Pekah, 739 to 731. Hoshea, 731 to 722. And in 722, of course, the northern kingdom fell to the Assyrians. And it's rather ironic that the last king of the northern kingdom is named Hoshea. He has the same name as the prophet we're studying. So those were the kings of the northern kingdom. So what is our conclusion regarding the time frame of the book of Hosea? Apparently he prophesied between 790 and 722. The span could actually be a little bigger than that. The span could be as much as 70 to 100 years if you look at it from different points of view. But probably between 790 and 722. He was a successor to Amos. He was also a contemporary with Micah and Isaiah, and they were in the southern kingdom at this time. So what was his locale? Point D, his locale is Israel, the northern kingdom. And this is shown by the fact that his interest and the places that he mentions are primarily in Israel, only a few side warnings to the southern kingdom of Judah. Another indicator lies in the fact that the ruler of Samaria, the ruler of the northern kingdom, is stated to be our king in 7:5. And so that statement places Hosea under Israel's political sovereignty. So again, he was the only prophet to the north who was from the north. Amos prophesied to the north, but he came from the south. Jonah came from the north, but he prophesied to Nineveh. So he was the only prophet to the north who was from the north. All right, point nine, the historical setting of Hosea the prophet. This is a time of Assyrian ascendancy. Here is a map, again, of the Assyrian kingdom, the Assyrian Empire. And the red circle there shows you the approximate boundaries of the Assyrian Empire around 824 BC. But Assyria was on the move. Assyria was going to continue to grow, and by 671 she had grown to her maximum extent from Egypt all the way across the Middle East. And Judah, there's little Judah, was just a province in the middle of the Assyrian Empire. So it was a time of outward prosperity for Assyria. They were on the move. But it was also a time of outward prosperity for the two kingdoms of the Jewish people. The two kingdoms under Uzziah and Jeroboam II extended the boundaries of the kingdom to the boundaries of David and Solomon. All right, here's a map of Israel's expansion under Jeroboam II. Israel is the red area in the middle of the map. But territory that was brought under tribute to Israel is to the north, the purple area to the north, Phoenicia and parts of Syria with the city of Damascus. So Israel expanded to the north during this time, a time of prosperity for them. To the south, Judah also experienced the same kind of growth. Judah is the green area to the top of the slide to the north, but Judah expanded into Moab, into the Arabah, into Edom, into the Arabian, into the Sinai Peninsula. Judah expanded to the east and to the south and to the west. So this was a time of expansion for Judah as well. And this map shows Judah's expansion under Amaziah and Uzziah. Now, following the death of Jeroboam II in the north, the rule that followed was followed by periods of royal assassination and military rule. That's why there were so many kings for short times in the Northern Kingdom. Now, what was the religious picture in the Northern Kingdom? We've looked at the economic picture, geographical picture. Now, what about the religious picture? Well, it wasn't very pretty. It wasn't very pretty. Point A, the Northern Kingdom was very, very entranced in the worship of the Canaanite Baal. This is a false religion. This is outright idolatry. Now, here is a bronze figurine of Baal, of a Baal, dated the 14th to the 12th century BCE. This was found at Rosh Shamra, which is ancient Ugarit, near the Phoenician coast, just to the north of Israel. And this is found in the Louvre Museum in France. So there's one of the little idols that were worshipped. That's an idol of Baal. And this is a carving of Baal with a thunderbolt, found at the Acropolis in Rosh Shamra Ugarit as well. So this is the idol that many, many worshipped in the Northern Kingdom. Now, in the Southern Kingdom, things were not much brighter. There was worship of the golden calf. Well, in both kingdoms, there was worship of the golden calf. I should say, excuse me, let me correct that. In the Northern Kingdom, there was worship of the Canaanite Baal. And in the Northern Kingdom, there was worship of the golden calf. Now, this is false worship of the Lord. False worship of the Lord. Now, this is a picture of an Egyptian bronze figure of the Apis bull. Now, the bull worship, the worship of the Apis bull, began in Egypt and was probably the source of the golden calf during the Exodus. So here we have probably the instigation for golden calf worship. Now, this little silver calf was found in Ashkelon, dated from the Middle Bronze Age. So this might have been a little idol that was worshipped as well. And then we have an Israelite high place. The high places were areas of worship set up on the hills. And so this is a bronze bull. So we see that worship of the golden calf, worship of the bull, whatever, was very, very prominent in the area and in the Northern Kingdom. So in summary, idolatry and immorality were widespread in the Northern Kingdom. As a result, there's a number of evils listed by Hosea. Point A, murder and bloodshed. There's violence in the Northern Kingdom. It's marked by violence. Also, ironically, there are robbing and murdering gangs of priests going around. The priests were supposed to be the moral leaders and teachers of the nation, but here they're going around robbing and murdering. Adultery was widespread. Oppression of the poor was widespread. Idolatry was all over the place, and as a result, a tremendous amount of pride. Pride in their expansion, pride in their prosperity. So immorality was running rampant in the Northern Kingdom during Hosea's time. And so he was sent to prophesy to a doomed nation. Now let's stop for a second and do a little bit of application. One thing I'd like to share with you right now is that prosperity rarely leads to behavior that pleases God. Prosperity tends to lead toward immorality, self-sufficiency, and pride. You know, prosperity can be much more detrimental to your spiritual life than adversity. And this is something we need to take to heart here in the United States in the year 2015. If we are not the most prosperous nation on earth, we are one of the most prosperous nations on earth. And we have turned our backs on God, and we are going in a direction that insults God and ignores Him. And not only is the nation becoming more and more secular, and less and less trusting in God. You know, our motto, "In God We Trust," is becoming kind of foolish. And people have even criticized the motto and want to get rid of it. Because atheism is growing in the United States at this time. We need to take this to heart. And you know, the church was expected by the founding fathers. The church was expected to teach morality and teach the way of God and educate the people and turn them toward the Lord so we would trust in Him. But the church has failed miserably up to this point. And right now in 2015, the church in many areas is leading the charge into immorality and criticizing the Bible, saying it's just a bunch of myths, that it's not true. It might have some good mythical applications to our lives, but certainly most of it is just false myths. So the church is falling into the trap as well. So we are in a difficult time here in the United States, turning away from God. Well, what are the dangers of prosperity? Well, the dangers of prosperity are listed in Scripture. I'm not just talking out of my head here. Paul, in 1 Timothy 6, 9 and 10, writes about the dangers of prosperity. He says, but those who want to get rich, those that want money, fall into what? Fall into temptations and a snare, into traps. Temptations and traps, and many foolish and harmful desires, which plunge men into ruin and destruction. So lust after money, lust after prosperity is a trap, something to avoid. It's very dangerous. He continues, for the love of money is a root of all sorts of evil, and some, by longing for it, have wandered away from the faith and pierced themselves with many griefs. Wandered away from the faith. That's exactly what the United States is doing, and that's exactly what the church in the United States is doing. And we are going to suffer for it. We're going to suffer grief for this. So there's great danger in prosperity. Secondly, the writer of Proverbs warns us about prosperity and riches. He says, do not worry yourself to gain wealth. Cease from your consideration of it. When you set your eyes on it, it is gone. For wealth certainly makes itself wings like an eagle that flies toward the heavens. And his point here is that prosperity and wealth is not dependable. You can't consider it the foundation of your life. I mean, many people here in the United States in the last few years have lost everything when our economic bubble burst for a few years and we went through the Great Recession. It can be gone in the snap of a finger. So you shouldn't depend on wealth. It's not dependable. And the writer of Ecclesiastes, the preacher of Ecclesiastes, tells us that prosperity is unsatisfying. He says, he who loves money will not be satisfied with money, nor he who loves abundance with its income. This too is vanity. And so many people in this world just striving after money, striving after abundance. You know, if I just had a bigger car, if I just had a bigger house, if I just had a bigger bank account, I would be satisfied. But you know, there's an old saying that apparently it's accredited to a number of the rich men in our country in the past. So you can find it accredited to any number of very wealthy men. How much money does it take to be satisfied? And the rich man says, just $1 more. Just $1 more. So prosperity is not satisfying. And then the proper attitude toward prosperity is laid out for us in a number of verses in the Bible. For example, in Proverbs 38 and 9, the writer of Proverbs is praying. He prays to the Lord, keep deception and lies far from me. And then here's the key phrase for our study today. Give me neither poverty nor riches. Keep me in the middle class, Lord. Don't make me poor. Don't make me rich. Feed me with the food that's my portion. Feed me with the appropriate amount of food, of prosperity. Why? Why does he say that? Why does the writer of Proverbs want to be in the middle? First of all, he doesn't want to be rich because he goes on to say, that I not be full and deny you and say, who is the Lord? See, we get rich, we get our cars, we get our houses, we get our retirement, and we don't need the Lord. You know, we got life all squared away. You know, I got my retirement program. I'm on top of the world. What does God have to do with this? I've done this all for myself. I'm a self-made man. See, if you get rich, you can be full and you can deny the Lord. The other side of the coin is also not desirable. He doesn't want to be poor, that I not be in want and steal and profane the name of my God. So the writer of Proverbs says, stay in the middle. Stay balanced between the two. Don't lift up poverty. Don't lift up prosperity. Stay in the middle. Be in the middle class. That's a proper attitude toward prosperity. And the word to sum all that up would be found in 1 Timothy 6, 6-8. Paul writes, godliness actually is a means of great gain when accompanied by contentment. That's the key attitude we need to have toward prosperity. For we have brought nothing into the world, so we cannot take anything out of it either. You can't take it with you. That's an old proverb, right? If we have food and covering with these, we shall be content. Be content with what we've got. That's the proper attitude. Well, those in the Northern Kingdom didn't heed thoughts like that, and they were not content. They were striving after prosperity. All right, page 10. Come to point F, the major points of the book of Hosea. First of all, sin. First major point, Israel is guilty of gross sin, both in the economic and the religious realms. Secondly, a major point is Israel's lack of knowledge. That in turn leads to destruction, knowledge of God. Knowledge of God is very important. If you lack knowledge of God, you'll be depending on the knowledge of men. And the Bible says there's a way that seems right unto a man, but the end thereof is the way of death, destruction. Don't depend on man's knowledge, because the heart of man is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. Who can know it? Lack of knowledge of God leads to destruction. A third major point is judgment. God will judge sin. He will not let us get away with it. He will not let Israel get away with it. He will not let the church get away with it. He will not let you and I get away with it. We are responsible to Him. But while God will judge us for our sin, He is still characterized by love. And God's love remains solid in spite of Israel's sin, in spite of the church's sin, in spite of your and my sin. God's love remains solid for us. This is the exact opposite of what replacement theology teaches. Replacement theology teaches that Israel sinned against God. Israel rejected God, and so God replaced Israel with the church. Well, we'll get a little different message as we go through Hosea and as we go through the minor prophets. The church has not replaced Israel. God's love has remained solid for Israel. But that doesn't eliminate judgment. We'll talk about that later on. Fifthly, God's love, God's solid love, will eventually result in an ultimate salvation. An ultimate salvation will be experienced by those who love the Lord. Point G on your outline. The book of Hosea is quoted in the New Testament about 9 times. We see Hosea 2:23 and 1:10, quoted in Romans 9:25 and 26, and 1 Peter 2:10. Hosea 6:6, Matthew 9, Matthew 12, Mark 12. Hosea 11:1, Matthew 2:15. Hosea 10:8 in Luke 23 and Revelation 6. And Hosea 13:14 in 1 Corinthians 15:55. So the book is referred to a good number of times in the New Testament. The theme is God's love for Israel. God's solid, steady love for Israel. Okay, well, let's get back to our text here. Our text stated, point I at the bottom of the page, the word of the Lord that came to Hosea. So we see here that God is directly influencing the mind of Hosea. This is inspiration. This is God's word, not man's word, and God's word is going to be recorded accurately. Accurately. This is verbal plenary inspiration. God is directly influencing Hosea's mind. The literal Hebrew says, Asher Hayael. It took possession of Hosea. Would be a very literal translation there. Asher Hayael. It took possession of Hosea. And of course, is the result is prophetic revelation, inspiration. All right, page 11 of your outline. We now turn to chapter 1, verse 2, to chapter 3, verse 5, and the message of Hosea's marriage. Point A, we come to the first commission to Hosea of a number of commissions in chapter 1, verse 2, to chapter 2, verse 1. And the commission consists of references to his wife and his children in chapter 1, verses 2 through 9. We begin with references to the wife, and the commission is given in chapter 1, first part of the verse. Hosea chapter 1, verse 2a. When the Lord first spoke through Hosea, the Lord said to Hosea, "Go, take to yourself a wife of harlotry and have children of harlotry." Now we learn that he says at the first, when the Lord first spoke to him. This is the beginning of his prophetic ministry. This is the first direct revelation to Hosea. And it is a very strange request. So this is the beginning of his ministry. So we're dealing, and on our time frame chart, with the prophet's present time, 781 BC. Verses, chapter 1, verses 1 through 3 deal with the prophet's present time. Now he's told to take a wife of whoredom, to marry a prostitute. Now some have objected to this by saying this is in conflict with the Mosaic law, but that's really not the case. Marrying a prostitute was only forbidden for a priest in Leviticus 21, verse 7 and verse 14. But Hosea is not a priest or a Levite. And he's told to have children of whoredom. Now, some commentators take the position that these were children that had to be adopted. They were already born as a result of prostitution. I don't think that's the strongest position, but you will see that in commentators. The NASB rendered the verse with the word have children. They put it in italics, which means it's a translator's insertion. And I think that they've done a good job there. I'll talk about the what is the best understanding of this verse in just a moment. Have children of prostitution. Now, why is God giving Hosea this strange request? And Hosea is going to have this strange action. Well, his marriage is going to become a lesson for Israel. It's going to be an audio-visual lesson for the nation. All right, so that's the first part of verse 2. Now let's look at the second part of verse 2. For the land commits flagrant harlotry, forsaking the Lord. So we see that the commission concerns the nation. The nation is guilty of spiritual immorality. The wife will represent the nation as a whole. So this woman here will be guilty of physical immorality. That's the parallel. And the children represent individuals in the nation, the people in the nation. Now the Sanchino books of the Bible, summarizes the three interpretive positions around these verses, the allegorical, the literal, and the anticipatory position. Let me read that to you. Ibn Ezra, if you're not familiar with Ibn Ezra, that's a Jewish commentator. Ibn Ezra repudiates the suggestion that the command is to be understood literally. The chapter is, according to him, the record of a vision which is to be interpretive allegorically. So it's just a vision. It never really happened. It's just an allegory. We don't take that position here at Hanavar. Secondly, so that's the allegorical position, the interpretation. Secondly, some Talmudic authorities held it to be a command which Hosea literally obeyed to impress his contemporaries with the heinousness of their infidelity. And that's more in line with the Peshat, the literal position. And here's the third position, the anticipatory position. Most moderns explain the words as meaning a woman who would lapse into harlotry. Not that she was a harlot at the time of the marriage. Otherwise, the Hebrew would have been Isha Zonah. It was only a reflection when Gomer's character had become manifest that Hosea saw how this divinely ordered marriage was the symbol of Israel's apostasy from God, and his own love for the erring wife was a prophecy of Israel's unfailing compassion for Israel. And that's basically the position we'll take here at Hadavar, the anticipatory position. I think we'll see as we go through the next few verses that this is the best position to take, that she was not a prostitute when Hosea married her, but she lapsed into immorality and prostitution after they were married. All right, does Hosea obey the word of the Lord? You're darn tootin' he does. Hosea 1:3 deals with the obedience. He was a godly man. So he went and took Gomer, the daughter of Diblaim, and she conceived and bore him a son. Now this name, Gomer, means perfection or completion. And the word Diblaim means double fig cakes. It's an erotic symbol found in the Song of Solomon, chapter 2, verse 13. And so you put these two ideas together and you see that she is a perfect daughter of pleasure. Her name reflects her actions. Now, three children are born after the marriage, and each have God-given names designed to illustrate a point. We'll see that in just a few minutes. You know, this is exactly what Isaiah, Hosea's contemporary, Isaiah was experiencing. It was happening in Hosea's life, too. So God is using two contemporary prophets to speak to the nation, the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom, using the same kind of illustration. Children with names that have significance to the nation. So Hosea was prophesying using this technique to the northern kingdom. Isaiah was prophesying using this technique to the southern kingdom. So now we come to the children on page 12. And the verses listed there are, under point B, are 3B through 9. I'd like you to correct that. That's a typo. It should be 4 through 9. And then under the term Jezreel, 3b through 5, correct that to read 4 through 5. Should be verse 4 there instead of 3b. So now we come to the children in the verses 4 through 9. So let's take a look at the time frames at this point. We were in the prophet's present time, 781 BC. Now we move to the near future, 752 BC. And Jezreel in verses 4 and 5. He's talking about what will happen in the near future, verses 4 and 5. So let's read verses 4 and 5. The Lord said to him, "Name him Jezreel, for yet a little while I will punish the house of Jehu for the bloodshed of Jezreel, and I will put an end to the kingdom of the house of Israel." So the first child is born, he's a son, and Hosea is the father. And the in verse we finish up, "On that day I will break the bow of Israel in the valley of Jezreel." Now the Sanchino commentary makes a comment here. Ehrlich remarked that him is omitted in verses 6 and 8. From this he concluded that the paternity of the first child was not in doubt. But after his birth, Gomer became unfaithful to her husband. So that's the anticipatory interpretation that we're taking. The first child has been fathered by Hosea without a doubt, but there is doubt regarding the next two. Now, what is the meaning of Jezreel? Well, Jezreel can mean one of two things. It can mean either God scatters or God sows. And both of these renderings will be applicable to the nation. Now, first of all, sowing was done by scattering or broadcasting the seed many times in that culture. So here's a picture of broadcast sowing. The farmer is walking through the plowed field and he's reaching into his bag of seed or whatever he's carrying, and he's just scattering the seed. He's just scattering the seed over the land. So that's called broadcast sowing. So God scatters. The application of the name Jezreel is in point B. I will avenge the blood of Jezreel upon the house of Jehu. You know, Jehu destroyed the entire house of Ahab, and he was commanded to do so, but he did so with an improper motive. He didn't do it to reestablish the worship of the Lord. He did it to gain full power for himself. Now, he destroyed Baal worship, but then instead of setting up worship of the Lord, he set up golden calf worship. This is Jehu's big mistake. The historical account of Jehu is found in 2 Kings 9 and 10. The fulfillment of this prophecy is 2 Kings 15, 8 through 12. The house of Jehu fell in 752 BC with the murder of Zechariah. And so this is a short-term prophecy that validated Hosea. He preached it in 781. In 752, the house of Jehu fell. The result of this prophecy: I will break the bow of Israel in the valley of Jezreel. Break the bow. That means the kingdom, the northern kingdom, will be weakened. The bow is a symbol of power. The kingdom will be broken up, and the place of the breakup will be the valley of Jezreel. Now, where is the valley of Jezreel located? Here is a map of what we call Israel today, of modern Israel. And the Valley of Jezreel is located right here. To the south lies the Judean Mountains. To the north lies the Galilee, and the Jezreel Valley running east and west between the two. Now, here is a map of a modern map of Israel. Again, you can see at the bottom of the mountain of the map, Mount Carmel in the brown, to the then the Jezreel Valley in green, and then the Galilee. Upper Galilee and Lower Galilee to the north. So the Jezreel Valley just between the two, where the modern cities of Haifa, Afula, and Beit Shan are located. So that's the Jezreel Valley. Here is a picture of the Jezreel Valley, a wide, spacious, fertile, productive valley. Beautiful place. You can see in the middle of this picture that there's a IDF airport, IDF airbase, in the Jezreel Valley. So this is where it will happen. Now, there's a play upon words here in the Hebrew, the play upon words of Israel and Jezreel. Basically, we're Israel and, Jezreel and Israel sound very much the same. And it can be the play on words can be rendered in the English fairly decently. The meaning is that Israel will be scattered in the valley of scattering. Okay, that's basically a rendering of the play on words in English. Israel will be scattered in the valley of scattering. So the result will be the scattering. The Assyrians will defeat Israel in this valley. This will be a reversal of Gideon's victory in Judges 6:33 through 7:23. There, in the Jezreel Valley, Gideon won the victory with only 300 men. But it will not be the case in Hosea's day when Assyria comes in. So this is fulfilled by the Assyrian capture of Galilee in 2 Kings 15:29. There we read, "In the days of Pekah, king of Israel, Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria, came and captured Ilon and Beth-Abal-Makkah and Yanoah and Kadesh and Hazor and Gilead and Galilee, all the land of Naphtali, and he carried them captive into Assyria." So there's the destruction brought by Assyria. And the Assyrians would then go on and besiege Jerusalem as well. All right, let's take a look at verse 6. We're on page 13, verse 6. "Then she conceived again and gave birth to a daughter. And the Lord said to him, 'Name her Lo-Ruhamah, for I will no longer have compassion on the house of Israel that I would ever forgive them.'" So this is the second child, a daughter. And here we move from 752, the time of Jezreel, in verses 4 and 5. We move forward in the time frame a slight bit to the near future and the destruction by Assyria in 722 BC, in verses 6 and 7. Now, the meaning of Lo-Ruhamah, the meaning of the name, is no mercy. The name comes from the word racham, a womb. Womb love. You know, it speaks of womb love speaks of a mother's gentle, soft compassion and intense bonding for her child in her womb. But in this case, there will be no mercy, none of this womb love, no mercy for Israel. There'll be an exception, however, for the kingdom of Judah in verse 7. But I will have compassion on the house of Judah and deliver them by the Lord their God, and will not deliver them by bow, sword, battle, horses, or horsemen. Judah remained more faithful and will be spared the Assyrian destruction. So the Lord will save them by the Lord their God. Did you notice in verse 7? The Lord will save them by the Lord their God. Two lords are mentioned there, two references to God. God who is speaking will save them by the instrument of God. God who is speaking will save them by the instrument of God. There's an implication of plurality in the Godhead here. Now, this is just a hint. It is not a proof of the triune nature of God, but is definitely an indicator. And so this compassion upon Judah will not be by means of military power. The Assyrian army will be destroyed by the angel of the Lord. And this is covered in Isaiah chapter 36 and 37. All right, now we move into the future. On our time frame, we now move in verses 6 and 7 into the Lo-Ami period in verses 8 and 9. The Lo-Ami period began with the Messiah's first coming in AD 30, and it will continue through the tribulation period. We are living in the Lo-Ami period right now, verses 8 and 9. Let's read the verses. When she had weaned Lo-Ruhamah, she conceived and gave birth to a son, and the Lord said to him, "Name him Lo-Ami, for you are not my people, I am not your God." So the meaning of Lo-Ami is not my people, and the application to the nation, the northern kingdom for a time, temporarily, the northern kingdom for a time will not be God's people, nor will the Lord be their God. Now, positionally, according to the Abrahamic covenant, Israel is always God's people. Romans 11:1, Romans 11:29. Romans 11:1 reads, "I say then, God has not rejected his people, has he? May it never be." I want any replacement theologians in the class to note that. God has not rejected his people, has he? May it never be. He's speaking of the nation Israel there in Romans 11:1. That's the context. And the proof, for I too am an Israelite. I'm a Jew, a descendant of Abraham, of the tribe of Benjamin. God has not rejected his people in Romans 11:1. Why? Because in Romans 11:29, for the gifts and the calling of God are irrevocable. And he's referring here to the Abrahamic covenant. The Abrahamic covenant is irrevocable. So, experientially, the experience of experiencing the blessings of the Abrahamic covenant is conditioned upon obedience. The Abrahamic covenant is irrevocable. But when Israel is living in a state of disobedience, we are not God's people experientially. We remain God's people positionally, but not experientially. And the idea here is that God will pour out his discipline upon us. That's the idea. When we're living in a state of disobedience, the Jewish people will be disciplined. Now, we're just about to the end of our time here. And at this point in time, I would like to present you with an overview of the Abrahamic covenant. However, we're running out of time, and so it would not be good to rush through the Abrahamic covenant and stop in the middle of it. So we'll go ahead and call it quits for this session, and we'll pick it up next week with at verse 8 and 9 with an overview of the Abrahamic covenant. So again, thanks for being part of our study this session. Shalom.